as Gabriel told the team the story of a well-deserved family vacation that was not to be. Summoned to Rome by Archbishop Luigi Donati, he had learned that Pope Paul VII, a man who had done so much to undo the Catholic Church's terrible legacy of anti-Semitism, had died under mysterious circumstances. Though skeptical that the Holy Father had been murdered, Gabriel had nonetheless agreed to use the resources of the office to undertake an informal investigation. It led him to Florence, where he witnessed the brutal killing of a missing Swiss guard, and then to a cottage outside Fribourg, where an unfinished letter fell from a framed picture of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. The letter concerned a book His Holiness had discovered in the Vatican secret archives, a book purportedly based on the memoirs of the Roman prefect of Judea who sentenced Jesus to death by crucifixion, a book that contradicted the accounts of Jesus' death contained in the canonical Gospels, accounts that were the seedbed of 2,000 years of sometimes murderous anti-Semitism. The book was missing, but the men who took it were hiding in plain sight. They were members of a reactionary and secretive Catholic order founded in southern Germany by a priest who found much to admire in the politics of the European far right, especially National Socialism. The spiritual descendants of this priest, whose name was Ulrich Schiller, planned to steal the approaching papal conclave and elect one of their own as the next supreme pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. As chief of the office, Gabriel had determined that such a development would not be in the interests of the State of Israel or Europe's 1.5 million Jews. Therefore, it was his intention to help his friend Luigi Donati steal the conclave back. To do so required undeniable proof of the order's plot. Time was of the essence. Gabriel needed the information no later than Thursday night, the eve of the conclave. Fortunately, he had identified two important lay members involved in the conspiracy. One was a reclusive German industrialist named Jonas Wolf. The other was a former BFV officer named Andreas Estermann. Estermann would be arriving at Café Adagio on the Beethovenplatz at 6 p.m. Wednesday. He would be expecting a Swiss intelligence officer named Christoph Bittel. He would find the office instead. Immediately following his abduction, he would be brought to the Munich safe house for questioning. Gabriel decreed that the interrogation would not be a fishing expedition. Estermann would merely sign his name to a statement the team had already prepared, a bill of particulars detailing the order's plot to steal the conclave. A retired professional, he would not break easily. Leverage would be required. The team would have to find that too. All in a span of just 30 hours. They lodged not a word of protest and posed not a single question. Instead, they opened their laptops, established secure links to Tel Aviv, and went to work. 2 hours later, as a gentle snow whitened the lawns of the Englischer Garten, they fired their first shot. Chapter 37. Munich. The email that landed on Andreas Estermann's phone a few seconds later appeared to have been sent by Christoph Bittel. In truth, it had been dispatched by a 22-year-old MIT-educated hacker from Unit 8200 in Tel Aviv. It sat on Esserman's device for nearly 20 minutes, long enough for Gabriel to fear the worst. Finally, Esserman opened it and clicked on the attachment, a decade-old photograph of a Swiss-German gathering of spies in Bern. In doing so, he unleashed a sophisticated malware attack that instantly seized control of the phone's operating system. Within minutes, it was exporting a year's worth of emails, text messages, GPS data, telephone metadata, and internet browsing history, all without Esterman's knowledge. The unit bounced the material securely from Tel Aviv to the safe house, along with a live feed from the phone's microphone and camera. Even Esterman's calendar entries, past and future, were theirs to peruse at will. On Wednesday evening, he had a single appointment, drinks at Café Adagio, 6 o'clock. Esterman's contacts contained the private mobile numbers of Bishop Hans Richter and his private secretary, Father Marcus Graf. Both succumbed to malware attacks launched by Unit 8200, as did Cardinal Camerlengo Domenico Albanese and Cardinal Archbishop Franz von Emmerich of Vienna, the man whom the order had selected to be the next pope. Elsewhere in Esterman's contacts, the team found evidence of the Order's astonishing reach. It was as if an electronic version of Father Schiller's leather-bound ledger had fallen into their laps. There were private phone numbers and email addresses for Austrian Chancellor Jörg Kaufmann, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Saviano, Cécile Leclerc of France's Popular Front, Peter van der Meer of the Dutch Freedom Party, and, of course, Axel Brunner of Germany's far-right National Democrats. Analysis of the phone's metadata revealed that Estermann and Brunner had spoken 5 times during the past week alone, a period that coincided with Brunner's sudden surge in German public opinion polls. Fortunately for the team, Estermann conducted much of his personal and professional correspondence via text message. For sensitive communications, he used a service that promised end-to-end encryption and complete privacy, a promise Unit 8200 had long ago rendered empty. Not only was the team able to see his current text in real time, they were able to review his deleted messages as well. Gabriel's name featured prominently in several exchanges, as did Luigi Donati's. Indeed, Donati had appeared on the Order's early warning system within hours of the Holy Father's death. The Order had been aware of Gabriel's arrival in Rome and of his presence in Florence. It had learned of his visit to Switzerland from Father Erich, the village priest from Rechthalten. The phone betrayed that Estermann had visited Switzerland as well. GPS data confirmed he spent 49 minutes in Café du Gothard in Fribourg on the Saturday after the Holy Father's death. Afterward, he had driven to Bonn, where he switched off the phone for a period of 2 hours and 57 minutes. If there was a bright spot, it was the cleanliness of Estermann's personal life. The team found no evidence of a mistress or fondness for pornography. Estermann's consumption of news was broad but tilted decidedly to the right. Several of the German websites he visited daily trafficked in false and misleading stories that inflamed public opinion against Muslim immigrants and the political left. Otherwise, he had no nasty browsing habits. But no man is perfect, and few are without at least one weakness. Estermann's, it turned out, was money. Analysis of his encrypted text messages revealed that he was in regular contact with a certain Herr Hassler, owner of a private bank in the Principality of Liechtenstein. Analysis of Herr Hassler's records, conducted without his consent, revealed the existence of an account in Estermann's name. The team had found numerous such accounts spread throughout the world, but the one in tiny Liechtenstein was different. Estermann's wife, Johanna, is the beneficiary, said Dina Sarid. What's the current balance? Asked Gabriel. Just north of €1.5 million. When was it opened? About 3 months ago. He's made 16 deposits. Each one was €100,000 exactly. If you ask me, he's skimming from the payments he's making to the cardinals. What about the Vatican Bank? The accounts of 12 of the cardinal electors have received large wire transfers in the last 6 weeks. 4 were over €1 million. The rest were around 800,000. All of them can be traced back to Estermann. But the ultimate source of the money was the secretive Munich-based conglomerate that Alessandro Ricci had described as the Order of St. Helena Incorporated. Elie Lavon, the team's most experienced financial investigator, took it upon himself to penetrate the company's defenses. They were formidable, which came as no surprise. After all, he had matched wits with the Order once before. 20 years ago, he had been at a distinct disadvantage. Now, he had Unit 8200 in his corner, and he had Jonas Wolf. The German businessman proved to be as elusive as the company that bore his name, beginning with the basics of his biography. As far as Lavon could tell, Wolf had been born somewhere in Germany, sometime during the war. He'd been educated at Heidelberg University, of that Lavon was certain, and had earned a PhD in applied mathematics. He acquired his first company, a small chemical firm, in 1970 with money borrowed from a friend. Within 10 years, he'd expanded into shipping, manufacturing, and construction. And by the mid-1980s, he was an extraordinarily wealthy man. He purchased a graceful old townhouse in the Maxvorstadt district of Munich, and a valley high in the Obersalzberg, northeast of Berchtesgaden. It was his intention to create a baronial refuge for his family and their descendants. But when his wife and 2 sons were killed in a private plane crash in 1988, Wolf's mountain redoubt became his prison. Once or twice a week, weather permitting, he traveled to Wolf Group's headquarters in North Munich by helicopter. But for the most part, he remained in the Obersalzberg, surrounded by his small army of bodyguards. He had not granted an interview in more than 20 years. Not since the release of an unauthorized biography that accused him of arranging the plane crash that killed his family. Reporters who tried to pry open the locked rooms of his past faced financial ruin or, in the case of a meddlesome British investigative journalist, physical violence. Wolf's involvement in the reporter's death, she was killed by a hit-and-run driver while cycling through the countryside near Devon, was much rumored but never proven. To Elie Lavon, the story of Jonas Wolf's spectacular rise sounded too good to be true. There was, for a start, a loan Wolf had received to purchase his first company. Lavon had a hunch, based on hard-won experience, that Wolf's lender had been a Kantonzug-based concern known as the Order of St. Helena. Furthermore, Lavon was of the opinion, again it was merely well-informed conjecture, that the Wolf Group was far larger than advertised. Because it was an entirely private company, one that had never received a single loan from a single German bank, Lavon's options for traditional financial inquiry were limited. Estermann's phone, however, opened many doors within the firm's computer network that might otherwise have remained closed, even to the cyber sleuths at Unit 8200. Shortly after 8 o'clock that evening, they tunneled into Jonas Wolf's personal database and found the keys to the kingdom, a 200-page document detailing the company's global holdings and the staggering income they generated. $2.5 billion in pure profit last year alone, announced Lavon. And where do you think it all goes? That evening, the team set aside its work long enough to share a traditional family meal. Mikhail Abramov and Natalie Mizrahi were absent, however, for they dined at Café Adagio in the Beethovenplatz. It was located in the basement level of a yellow building on the square's northwestern flank. By day it served bistro fare, but at night it was one of the neighborhood's most popular bars. Mikhail and Natalie pronounced the food mediocre, but judged the likelihood of successfully abducting a patron to be quite high.
3 stars on the Michelin scale, quipped Mikhail upon their return to the safe house. If Esteban comes to Café Adagio alone, he leaves in the back of a van.
The team took delivery of the vehicle in question, a Mercedes transit van, at 9 the following morning, along with 2 Audi A8 sedans, 2 BMW motor scooters, a set of false German registration plates, 4 Jericho 45-caliber pistols, an Uzi Pro compact submachine gun, and a 9mm Beretta with a walnut grip. At which point the tension in the safe house seemed to rise by several notches. As was often the case, Gabriel's mood darkened as the 0 hour drew near. Mikhail reminded him that a year earlier, in a warehouse in a drab commercial district of Tehran, a 16-member team had blowtorched its way into 32 safes and removed several hundred computer disks and millions of pages of documents. The team had then loaded the material into a cargo truck and driven it to the shore of the Caspian Sea, where a boat had been waiting. The operation had shocked the world and proved once again that the office could strike at will, even in the capital of its most implacable foe.
And how many Iranians did you have to kill in order to get out of the country alive?
Details, details, said Mikhail dismissively. The point is, we can do this with our eyes closed.
I'd rather you do it with your eyes open. It will substantially increase our chances of success.
By midday, Gabriel had managed to convince himself that they were doomed to failure, that he would spend the rest of his life in a German prison cell for crimes too numerous to recall, an ignoble end to a career against which all others would be measured. Elie Lavon accurately diagnosed the source of Gabriel's despair, for he was suffering from the same malady. It was Munich, thought Lavon, and it was the book. It was never far from their thoughts, especially Lavon's. There was not one member of the team whose life had not been altered by the longest hatred. Nearly all had lost relatives to the fires of the Holocaust. Some had been born only because one member of a family had found the will to survive. Like Isabel Feldman, the only surviving child of Samuel Feldman, who handed over a small fortune in cash and valuables to the Order of St. Helena in exchange for false baptismal certificates and false promises of protection.
Another such woman was Irene Frankel. Born in Berlin, she was deported to Auschwitz in the autumn of 1942. Her parents were gassed upon arrival, but Irene Frankel left Auschwitz on the death march in January 1945. She arrived in the new state of Israel in 1948. There she met a man from Munich, a writer, an intellectual who had escaped to Palestine before the war. In Germany, his name had been Greenberg, but in Israel, he had taken the name Alon. After marrying, they vowed to have 6 children, 1 for each million murdered, but a single child was all her womb could bear. She named the child Gabriel, the messenger of God, the interpreter of Daniel's visions. At 2 o'clock, they all realized it had been several minutes since anyone had seen him or heard his voice. A rapid search of the safe house revealed no trace of him, and a call to his phone received no answer. Unit 8200 confirmed the device was powered on and that it was moving through the Englischer Garten at a walking pace. Elie Lavon was confident he knew where it was headed. The child of Irene Frankel wanted to see where it had happened. Lavon couldn't blame him. He was suffering from the same malady. Chapter 38. Munich. In July 1935, 2.5 years after electorally seizing control of Germany, Adolf Hitler formally declared Munich the capital of the movement. The city's ties to National Socialism were undeniable. The Nazi Party was formed in Munich in the turbulent years after Germany's defeat in World War I. And it was in Munich in the autumn of 1923 that Hitler led the abortive beer hall putsch that resulted in his brief incarceration at Landsberg prison. There he penned the first volume of Mein Kampf, the rambling manifesto in which he described Jews as germs that needed to be exterminated. During his first year as chancellor, the year in which he transformed Germany into a totalitarian dictatorship, the book sold more than 1 million copies. Throughout the 15 cataclysmic years of the Nazi era, Hitler traveled to Munich frequently. He maintained a large, art-filled apartment at Prinz Regentenplatz 16 and commissioned the construction of a personal office building overlooking the Königsplatz. Known as the Führerbau, it contained living quarters for Hitler and his deputy, Rudolf Hess, and a cavernous central hall with twin stone staircases that led to a conference room. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain signed the Munich Agreement in the Führerbau on September 30, 1938. Upon his return to London, he predicted the accord would deliver peace in our time. A year later, the Wehrmacht invaded Poland, plunging the world into war and setting in motion the chain of events that would lead to the destruction of Europe's Jews. Much of central Munich was leveled by a pair of devastating Allied bombing raids in April 1944, but somehow the Führerbau survived. Immediately after the war, the Allies used it as a storage facility for looted art. It was now the home of a respected school of music and theater where pianists, cellists, violinists, and actors perfected their craft in rooms where murderers once walked. Bicycles lined the building's leaden facade, and at the foot of the main step stood 2 bored-looking Munich police officers. Neither paid any heed to the man of medium height and build who paused to review the schedule of upcoming public recitals. He continued past the Alte Pinakothek, Munich's world-class art museum, and then turned left onto the Heerstrasse. It was 10 minutes before he caught his first glimpse of the modern tower rising above the Olympic Park. The old Olympic village lay to the north, not far from the headquarters of BMW and a highly profitable German conglomerate known as the Wolf Group. He found the Kannerlestrasse and followed it to the squat 3-story apartment house at number 31. The building had long ago been converted into student housing, but in early September 1972, it had been inhabited by members of Israel's Olympic team. At 4:30 a.m. on September 5th, 8 Palestinian terrorists, dressed in tracksuits, scaled an undefended fence. Carrying duffel bags filled with Kalashnikov rifles, Tokarev semi-automatic pistols, and Soviet-made hand grenades, they used a stolen key to unlock the door of apartment 1. 2 Israelis, wrestling coach Moshe Weinberg and weightlifter Yosef Romano, were murdered during the first moments of the siege. 9 others were taken hostage. For the remainder of that day, as a global television audience watched in horror, German authorities negotiated with two heavily disguised terrorists, one known as Issa, the other Tony. While across the street, the games continued. Finally, at 10 p.m., the hostages were flown by helicopter to Fürstenfeldbruck Air Base, where German police had put in place an ill-conceived rescue operation. It ended with the death of all nine Israelis. Within hours of the massacre, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir ordered a legendary office agent named Ari Shamron to send forth the boys. The operation was codenamed Wrath of God, a phrase chosen by Shamron to give his undertaking the patina of divine sanction. One of the boys was a gifted young painter from Bezalel Academy of Arts and Design named Gabriel Alon. Another was Eli Lavon, a promising biblical archaeologist. In the Hebrew-based lexicon of the team, Lavon was an Ayin, a tracker. Gabriel was an Aleph, an assassin. For 3 years, they stalked their prey across Western Europe and the Middle East, killing at night and in broad daylight, living in fear that at any moment they might be arrested by local authorities and charged as murderers. In all, 12 men died at their hands. Gabriel personally killed 6 of the terrorists with a .22-caliber Beretta pistol. Whenever possible, he shot the victims 11 times, one for each Jew murdered at Munich. When finally he returned to Israel, his temples were gray. Lavon was left with numerous stress disorders, including a notoriously fickle stomach that troubled him to this day. He crept up on Gabriel without a sound and joined him in front of the Konnerlistrasse 31. "I wouldn't do that again if I were you, Eli. You're lucky I didn't shoot you. I tried to make a bit of noise. Try harder next time." Lavon looked up toward the balcony of apartment 1. "Come here often?" "Actually, it's been a while." "How long?" 100 years, said Gabriel distantly. "I come here every time I'm in Munich, and I always think the same thing." "What's that, Ailey?" "Our Olympic team should never have been assigned to this building. It was too isolated. We expressed our concerns to the Germans a few weeks before the games began, but they assured us our athletes would be safe. Unfortunately, they neglected to tell us that German intelligence had already received a tip from a Palestinian informant that the Israeli team had been targeted. It must have slipped their minds. Why didn't they warn us? Why didn't they take steps to protect our athletes?"
"You tell me."
"They didn't tell us," said Lavon, "because they didn't want anything to spoil their post-war coming out party. Least of all, a threat against the descendants of the same people they had tried to exterminate just 30 years before. Remember, the German intelligence and security services were founded by men like Reinhard Gehlen, men who had worked for Hitler and the Nazis, men of the right who hated communism and Jews in equal measure. It's no wonder they were attracted to someone like Andreas Esserman." He turned to Gabriel. "Did you happen to notice the last job he held before his retirement?"
"Head of Department 2, the Counter-Extremism Division."
"So why is he spending so much time on the phone with the likes of Axel Brunner? And why does he have the private cell number of every far-right leader in Europe?" Lavon paused. "And why did he turn off his phone for 3 hours in Bonn the other night?"
"Maybe he has a girlfriend there."
"Esterman? He's a choir boy."
"A doctrinaire choir boy."
Lavon lifted his gaze once more toward the facade of the building. A light was burning in the window of apartment 1. "Do you ever imagine how differently our lives would have turned out if it hadn't happened?"
"Munich?"
"No," answered Lavon. "All of it. 2,000 years of hatred. We'd be as numerous as all the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Just as God promised Abraham. I'd be living in a grand apartment in the first district of Vienna. A leader in my field, a man of distinction. I'd spend my afternoons sipping coffee and eating strudel at Café Stacher, and my evenings listening to Mozart and Haydn. Occasionally, I'd visit an art gallery and see works by a famous Berlin painter named Gabriel Frankl, the son of Irene Frankl, the grandson of Viktor Frankl, perhaps the greatest German painter of the 20th century. Who knows? Perhaps I might even be wealthy enough to purchase one or two of his works." "I'm afraid life doesn't work that way, Eli."
"I suppose not.
but would it be too much to ask for them to stop hating us? Why is anti-Semitism on the rise again in Europe? Why is it not safe to be a Jew in this country? Why has the shame of the Holocaust worn off? Why won't it ever end?
9 words, said Gabriel. A silence fell between them. It was Lavon who broke it.
Who do you suppose it is?
The Gospel of Pilate? Lavon nodded.
Up a chimney. How appropriate.
Lavon's tone was uncharacteristically bitter. He started to light a cigarette but stopped himself.
It goes without saying that the Nazis were the ones who annihilated the Jews of Europe. But they could not have carried out the final solution unless Christianity had first plowed the soil. Hitler's willing executioners had been conditioned by centuries of church teachings about the evils of the Jews. Austrian Catholics made up a disproportionate share of the death camp officers, and the survival rates for Jews were far lower in Catholic countries. But thousands of Catholics risked their lives to protect us.
Indeed, they did. They chose to act on their own initiative rather than wait for encouragement from their pope. As a result, they saved their church from the moral abyss.
Lavon's eyes searched the old Olympic village. We should be getting back to the safe house. It will be dark soon.
It already is, said Gabriel. Lavon finally lit his cigarette.
Why do you suppose he switched off his phone for 3 hours the other night?
Esterman? Lavon nodded.
I don't know, answered Gabriel. But I intend to ask him. Maybe you should ask him about the Gospel of Pilate, too.
Don't worry, Ailey. I will.
When Gabriel and Lavon returned to the safe house, the members of the snatch team were gathered in the sitting room, dressed for an evening out at a trendy café in the Beethovenplatz. There was no outward sign of nerves other than the incessant tapping of Mikhail's forefinger against the arm of his chair. He was listening intently to the voice of Andreas Esterman, who was addressing the members of his senior staff about the need to increase security at all Wolf Group facilities, especially the chemical plants. It seemed Esterman had received a warning from an old contact at the BFV, a warning the team had overheard. The system, apparently, was blinking red. By 5:15, it was blinking red inside the safe house as well. The members of the snatch team took their leave in the same manner they had arrived, intermittently, alone or in pairs, so as not to attract attention from the neighbors. By 5:45, they all had reached their fail-safe points. Their quarry left Wolf Group headquarters 17 minutes later. Gabriel watched his progress on an open laptop computer, a blinking blue light on a map of central Munich, courtesy of the compromised phone. It had already told Gabriel nearly everything he needed to know to prevent the Order of St. Helena from stealing the conclave. Still, there were one or two matters Andreas Esterman needed to clear up. If he had any sense, he would offer no resistance. Gabriel was in a dangerously bad mood. They were in Munich, after all, the capital of the movement, the city where murderers once walked.
Chapter 39. Beethovenplatz, Munich.
Just north of Munich's central train station, the traffic came to an abrupt halt. It was another police checkpoint. There were several around the city, mainly near transportation hubs and in squares and markets where large numbers of pedestrians congregated. The entire country was on edge, bracing itself for the next attack. Even the BFV, Andreas Esterman's old service, was convinced another bombing was inevitable. Esterman was of a similar mind. Indeed, he had reason to believe the next attack would occur as early as tomorrow morning, probably in Cologne. If successful, the physical destruction and death toll would tear at the very soul of the country, touch an ancient nerve. It would be Germany's 9/11. Nothing would ever be the same. Esterman checked the time on his iPhone, then swore softly. Immediately he pleaded with God for forgiveness. The strictures of the order forbade all forms of profanity, not just those involving the Lord's name. Esterman did not smoke cigarettes or drink alcohol, and regular fasting and exercise helped to keep down his weight, despite a weakness for traditional German cooking.
His wife Johanna was a member of the order too. So were their six children. The size of their family was unusual in modern Germany, where birth rates had fallen below replacement level. Estermann again checked the time. 6:04. He dialed Christoph Bittel's number but received no answer. Then he dashed off a text message, explaining that he had left the office later than planned and was now stuck in traffic. Bittel replied instantly. It seemed he was running behind schedule as well, which was not like him. Bittel was usually as punctual as a Swiss timepiece. At last, the traffic inched forward. Estermann saw the reason for the delay. The police were searching a delivery van outside the entrance of the station. The passengers, two young men, Arabs or Turks, lay spread-eagled on the pavement. Estermann took no small amount of pleasure in their predicament. When he was a boy growing up in Munich, he rarely saw a foreigner, especially one with brown or black skin. That changed in the 1980s, when the floodgates opened. 12 million immigrants now resided in Germany, 15% of the population. The overwhelming majority were Muslims. Unless present trends were reversed, native Germans would soon be a minority in their own land. Estermann turned onto the Goethestrasse, a quiet street lined with elegant old apartment houses, and eased into an empty space along the curb at 6:10. He lost 3 additional minutes purchasing a chit from the automatic dispenser and another 2 walking the rest of the way to Café Adagio. It was a dimly lit room with a few tables arranged around a platform where, later that evening, a trio of American jazz musicians would perform. Estermann did not care for jazz, nor did he much like the clientele of Café Adagio. At a darkened table in the corner, 2 women, at least Estermann thought they were women, were kissing. A couple of tables away sat 2 men. One had a hard, pitted face, the other was thin as a reed. They looked like Eastern Europeans, maybe Jews. At least they weren't queers. Estermann hated queers even more than he hated Jews and Muslims. Bittel was nowhere to be seen. Estermann sat down at a table as far from the other patrons as possible. At length, a tattooed girl with purple hair wandered over. She looked at Estermann for a moment as though waiting for him to utter the secret password. Diet Coke. The waitress withdrew. Estermann checked his phone. Where the hell was Bittel? And why in God's name had he chosen a place like Café Adagio? Andreas Estermann's discomfort was so transparent that Gabriel waited 10 additional minutes before informing the German that, owing to a work emergency, Christoph Bittel would not be able to meet for a drink as planned. Estermann's face, viewed through the camera lens of his compromised phone, twisted into a grimace. He sent a curt response, tossed a 5-euro banknote onto the table, and stormed into the street. Fuming, he pounded along the pavements of the Goethestrasse to his car, where his rising anger boiled over. A man was sitting on the hood, his boots resting on the bumper, a girl between his legs. His pale skin was luminous in the lamplight. The girl was very dark, like an Arab. Her hands were resting on the man's thighs. Her mouth was on his. Estermann would have only limited memory of what happened next. There was an exchange of words, followed by an exchange of blows. Estermann threw a single wild punch, but was on the receiving end of several compact, carefully delivered elbows and knees. Incapacitated, he crumpled to the pavement. From somewhere a van materialized. Estermann was hurled into the back like war dead. He felt a sharp pain in his neck, and instantly his vision began to swim. The last thing he remembered before losing consciousness was the face of the woman. She was an Arab. He was sure of it. Estermann hated Arabs, almost as much as he hated Jews. Chapter 40. Munich. There is no such thing, practitioners of the secret trade like to say, as a perfect covert operation. The best a careful planner can do is limit the chances of failure and exposure, or, worse still, of arrest and prosecution. Sometimes the planner willingly accepts a modicum of risk when lives are at stake or his cause is just. And sometimes he must resign himself to the fact that a small measure of serendipity of providence will determine whether his ship reaches port safely or smashes itself to pieces on the rocks. Gabriel struck just such a bargain with the operational gods that evening in Munich. Yes, he had lured Andreas Estermann to Cafe Adagio for what he thought was a meeting with an old acquaintance. But it was Esterman, not Gabriel, and his team, who had selected the place of his abduction. Fortunately, Esterman chose well. There was no traffic camera to record his disappearance, and no witness other than a dachshund in the window of an adjacent apartment building. 90 minutes later, after a brief stop in the countryside west of Munich for a change of license plates, the van returned to the safe house near the Englischer Garten. Bound and blindfolded, Andreas Esterman was transferred to a makeshift holding cell in the basement. Typically, Gabriel would have left him there for a day or two to ponder his fate, while deprived of sight, sound, and sleep. Instead, at 10:30, he instructed Natalie to hasten Esterman's return to consciousness. She injected him with a mild stimulant, along with a little something to take the edge off, something to distort his sense of reality, something to loosen his tongue. Consequently, Esterman offered no resistance when Mordechai and Oded secured him to a metal chair outside the holding cell. On the opposite side of a table, flanked by Yaakov Rossmann and Eli Lavon, sat Gabriel. Behind him was a tripod-mounted Solaris phone. Blindfolded, Esterman knew none of this. He only knew that he was in a great deal of trouble. The matter before him, however, was easily resolved. All that was required was his signature and a statement, a bill of particulars, names and numbers. At 10:34 p.m., Esterman's inquisitor spoke for the first time. The camera captured the expression and the portion of the German's face not concealed by the blindfold. Later, the video would be analyzed by the specialists at Kingsall Boulevard. All were in agreement on one point. It was a look of profound relief. Though cursed with a flawless memory, Gabriel sometimes found it hard to accurately recall his mother's face. Two of her self-portraits hung in his bedroom in Jerusalem. Each night, before he drifted off to sleep, he saw her as she had seen herself, a tormented figure rendered in the manner of the German expressionists. Like many young women who survived the Holocaust, she struggled with the demands of caring for a child. She was prone to melancholia and violent mood swings. She could not show pleasure on festive occasions and did not partake of rich food or drink. She wore a bandage always on her left arm, over the faded numbers tattooed into her skin. 29395. She referred to them as her mark of Jewish weakness, her emblem of Jewish shame. Painting, like motherhood, was an ordeal for her. Gabriel used to sit on the floor at her feet, scribbling in his sketchpad, while she labored at her easel. To distract herself, she used to tell stories of her childhood in Berlin. She spoke to Gabriel in German, in her thick Berlin accent. It was Gabriel's first language, and even now it was the language of his dreams. His Italian, while fluent, bore the faint but unmistakable trace of a foreigner's intonation. But not his German. No matter where he traveled in the country, no one ever assumed he was anything but a native speaker of the language, one who had been raised in the center of Berlin. Andreas Esterman clearly assumed that was the case as well, which prompted his misplaced expression of relief. It faded quickly once Gabriel explained why he had been taken into custody. Gabriel did not identify himself, though he implied he was a secret member of the Order of St. Helena, who had been asked by Herr Wolf and Bishop Richter to investigate certain financial irregularities that had recently come to their attention. These irregularities concerned the existence of a bank account in the Principality of Liechtenstein. Gabriel recited the current balance and the dates on which deposits had been made. Then he read aloud the text messages Esterman had exchanged with his private banker, Herr Hassler, lest Esterman entertain any thought of wriggling off the hook. Next, Gabriel turned his attention to the source of the money that Esterman had embezzled from the order. It was money, he said, that was supposed to have been delivered to the cardinal electors who had agreed to vote for the order's candidate at the coming conclave. At the mention of the prelate's name, Esterman gave a start and then spoke for the first time. With a single objection, he confirmed both the existence of the plot and the name of the cardinal whom the order had selected to be the next pope. "How do you know it's Emmerich?" "What do you mean?" asked Gabriel. "Only a handful of us are aware.
of the Conclave apparition.
I'm one of them.
But I would know who you are.
Why would you assume that?
I know the names of all the secret members of the Order.
Obviously, said Gabriel, that's not the case. Receiving no further protest, Gabriel returned to the topic of the payments. It seemed several of the prelates had informed Cardinal Albanese that the agreed-upon sums of cash had not appeared in their accounts.
But that's not possible. Father Graf told me last week that all the cardinals had received their money.
Father Graf is working with me on this matter. He misled you at my request.
Bastard.
The order forbids such language, Herr Esserman, especially when it concerns a priest.
Please, don't tell Bishop Richter.
Don't worry, it will be our little secret. Gabriel paused. But only if you tell me what you did with the money you were supposed to deliver to the cardinal electors.
I wired it into their accounts, just as Herr Wolf and Bishop Richter instructed. I never stole a single euro.
Why would the cardinals lie?
Isn't it obvious? They're trying to extort us into paying more money.
What about the account in Liechtenstein?
It is an operational account.
Why is your wife the beneficiary? Esterman was silent for a moment.
Do Herr Wolf and Bishop Richter know about the account?
Not yet, said Gabriel. And if you do everything I tell you, they never will.
What do you want?
I want you to call Herr Hassler first thing in the morning and tell him to wire that money to me.
Yes, of course. What else?
Gabriel told him.
All 42 names will be here all night.
Is there somewhere else you have to be?
My wife is expecting me for dinner.
I'm afraid you missed dinner a long time ago.
Can you at least remove the blindfold and these restraints?
The names, Herr Esterman, now.
Is there any particular order you want them?
How about alphabetically?
It would help if I had my phone.
You're a professional. You don't need your phone.
Esterman tilted his head toward the ceiling and drew a breath.
Cardinal Azevedo.
Tegucigalpa?
There's only one Azevedo in the College of Cardinals.
How much did you pay him?
1 million.
Where's the money?
Bank of Panama.
Next? Esterman cocked his head.
Ballantyne of Philadelphia.
How much?
1 million.
Where's the money?
The Vatican Bank.
Next. The last name on Esterman's list was Cardinal Peter Zichov, the Archbishop of Esztergom-Budapest, 1 million euros payable to his personal account at Banco Popolare, Hungary. All totaled, 42 of the 116 cardinal electors who would choose the successor to Pope Paul VII had received money in exchange for their votes. The total cost of the operation was slightly less than $50 million. Every penny of it had come from the coffers of the Wolf Group, the global conglomerate otherwise known as the Order of St. Helena, Incorporated.
And that's all of the names? Probed Gabriel. You're sure you haven't left anyone out?
Esterman shook his head vigorously.
The other 18 cardinals who will vote for Emmerich are members of the Order. They received no payment beyond their monthly stipends.
He paused.
And then there's Archbishop Donati, of course. 2 million euros. I deposited the money after he and the Israeli broke into the secret archives.
Gabriel glanced at Elie Lavon. And you're sure you didn't deposit that money in an account I don't know about?
No, said Esserman. It's in Donati's personal account at the Vatican Bank.
Gabriel turned to a fresh page in his notebook, despite the fact he hadn't bothered to write down a single name or number. Let's go through it one more time, shall we? Just to make certain we haven't missed anyone.
Please, begged Esterman. I have a terrible headache from the drugs you gave me.
Gabriel looked at Mordechai and Oded, and in German instructed them to return Esterman to the holding cell. Upstairs in the drawing room, he and Lavon reviewed the recording on a laptop computer. That clerical suit you wore into the secret archives the other day must have rubbed off on you. For a moment, even I was convinced you were a member of the Order. Gabriel advanced the recording and clicked play.
2 million euros. I deposited the money after he and the Israeli broke into the secret archives.
Gabriel clicked pause.
Rather clever on their part, don't you think?
They obviously don't intend to go down without a fight.
Neither do I. What do you have in mind?
I'm going to have a word with him. Gabriel paused. Face to face.
You've got everything you need, said Lavon. Let's get out of here before some nice German police officer knocks on the door and asks if we know anything about a missing senior executive from the Wolf Group.
We can't release him until white smoke rises from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel.
So we'll tape him to a tree somewhere in the Alps on our way down to Rome. With any luck, no one will find him until the glaciers melt.
Gabriel shook his head. I want to know why he has the private phone number of every major far-right leader in Western Europe. And I want that book.
It went up a chimney, you said so yourself.
Just like my grandparents.
Gabriel turned, without another word, and headed downstairs to the cellar. There he instructed Mordechai and Oded to remove Esterman from the holding cell. Once again, the German offered no resistance as he was secured to the chair. At 12:42 a.m., the blindfold was removed. The camera of the Solaris phone captured the expression on Esterman's face. Later, at Kingsall Boulevard, all were in agreement on one point. It was one of Gabriel's finest hours.
Chapter 41. Munich.
Natalie gave Esterman a handful of ibuprofen for his head and a plate of leftover Turkish takeaway. He swallowed the pain reliever tablets greedily, but turned up his nose at the food. He likewise ignored the glass of Bordeaux she placed before him.
"She looks like an Arab," he said when she was gone.
"She's from France, actually. She and her parents had to immigrate to Israel to escape the anti-Semitism there.
I hear it's very bad.
Almost as bad as Germany.
It's the immigrants who are causing problems, not ethnic Germans."
"Isn't it pretty to think so?" Gabriel looked at the untouched wine glass. "Have some, you'll feel better."
"Alcohol is forbidden by the order." Esterman frowned. "I would have thought you knew that."
He looked down at his plate without enthusiasm.
"I wonder if you might have any proper German food."
"That would be rather difficult, given the fact that we are no longer in Germany." Esterman adopted a superior smile.
"I've lived in Munich most of my life. I know how it smells, how it sounds. If I had to guess, we're in the city center, rather close to the Englischer Garten."
"Eat your food, Esterman. You're going to need your strength."
He wrapped two pieces of grilled lamb in a Baselma flatbread and hesitantly took a first bite.
"That wasn't so bad, was it?"
"Where did you get it?"
"A little takeaway near the Hauptbahnhof. That's where all the Turks live, you know. In my experience, that's generally the best place to get Turkish food."
Esterman ate one of the dolmades. "It's quite good, actually. Still, it's not what I would have chosen for my last meal."
"Why so glum, Esterman?"
"We both know how this is going to end."
"The ending," said Gabriel, "has yet to be written.
And what must I do to survive this night?"
"Answer every question I ask."
"And if I don't,
I'll be tempted to waste a perfectly good bullet on you."
Esterman lowered his voice.
"I have children, Alon."
6, said Gabriel, "a very Jewish number."
"Really? I never knew."
Esterman looked at the glass of wine.
"Have some," said Gabriel. "You'll feel better."
"It's forbidden."
"Live a little, Esterman."
He reached for the wine glass.
"I certainly hope so."
Andreas Esterman's story began, of all places, with the Munich massacre. His father had been a policeman too. "A real policeman," he added, "not the secret variety." In the early morning hours of September 5th, 1972, he was awakened with news that Palestinian guerrillas had kidnapped several Israeli athletes at the Olympic Village. He remained inside the command post during the day-long negotiations and witnessed the rescue attempt at Fürstenfeldbruck. Despite its failure, Esterman's father was awarded his department's highest commendation for his efforts that day. He tossed it in a drawer and never looked at it again.
Why?
He thought it was a disaster.
For whom?
Germany, of course.
What about the innocent Israelis who were murdered that night?
Esterman shrugged.
I suppose your father thought they had it coming to them?
I suppose he did.
He was a supporter of the Palestinians?
Hardly.
His father, Esterman continued, was a member of the Order of St. Helena, as was their parish priest. Esterman joined when he was a student at Munich's Ludwig Maximilian University. 3 years later, during a particularly chilly phase of the Cold War, he joined the BFV. By any objective measure, he had a fine career, the failure to disrupt the Hamburg cell notwithstanding. In 2008, he left the counterterrorism division and took command of Department 2, which monitored neo-Nazis and other right-wing extremists.
A bit like the fox guarding the henhouse, don't you think?
A bit, admitted Esterman with a wry smile. He kept a close eye on the worst of the worst, he continued, and helped federal prosecutors put a few behind bars. But for the most part, he worked to advance the country's rightward drift by shielding extreme political parties and groups from scrutiny, especially when it came to the source of their funding. On the whole, his term as director of Department 2 had been wildly successful. The German far right exploded in size and influence during his tenure. He retired from the BFV in 2014, 3 years ahead of schedule, and the next day went to work as head of security for the Wolf Group.
The Order of St. Helena, Incorporated.
You've obviously read Alessandro Ricci's book.
Why did you leave the BFV early?
I'd done everything I could from the inside. Besides, by 2014 we were close to achieving our goals. Bishop Richter and Herr Wolf decided that the project required my full attention.
The project?
Esterman nodded.
What was it?
A response to an incident that occurred at the Vatican in the autumn of 2006.
You might remember it.
In fact, said Esterman, I believe you were there that day.
He needlessly reminded Gabriel of the horrific details. The attack had occurred a few minutes after noon, during a Wednesday general audience in St. Peter's Square. Three suicide bombers, three shoulder-launch RPG-7s, a calculated insult to the Christian concept of the Trinity, which Islam regarded as polytheism, or shirk. More than 700 people were killed, making it the worst terrorist attack since 9/11. Among the dead were the commandant of the Swiss Guard, four curial cardinals, eight bishops, and three monsignori. The Holy Father would have died as well if Gabriel hadn't shielded his body from the falling debris.
And what did Lucchese and Donati do? Asked Esterman. They called for dialogue and reconciliation.
I assume the order had a better idea.
Islamic terrorists had just attacked the heart of Christendom. Their goal was to turn Western Europe into a colony of the Caliphate. Let's just say that Bishop Richter and Jonas Wolf were in no mood to negotiate the terms of Christianity's surrender. In fact, when discussing their plan, they borrowed a famous phrase from the Jews.
What was that?
Never again.
How flattering, said Gabriel. And the plan?
Radical Islam had declared war on the church and Western civilization. If the church and Western civilization could not summon the strength to fight back, the order would do it for them.
It was Jonas Wolf, he continued, who chose to call the operation the Project.
Bishop Richter had argued for something biblical, something with historical sweep and gravitas, but Wolf insisted on blandness over grandeur. He wanted a harmless-sounding word that could be used in an email or a phone conversation without raising suspicion.
And the nature of the project? Asked Gabriel.
It was to be a 21st-century version of the Reconquista.
I assume your ambitions weren't limited to the Iberian Peninsula.
No, said Esterman. Our goal was to erase the Islamic presence from Western Europe and restore the church to its proper place of ascendancy.
How?
The same way our founder, Father Schiller, waged a successful war against communism.
By throwing in your lot with fascists?
By supporting the election of traditionalist politicians in the predominantly Roman Catholic heartland of Western Europe.
His words had the dryness of a policy paper.
Politicians who would take the difficult but necessary steps to reverse current demographic trends.
What sort of steps?
Use your imagination.
I'm trying, and all I can see are cattle cars and smokestacks.
No one's talking about that.
You're the one who used the word erase, Esterman, not me.
Do you know how many Muslim immigrants there are in Europe? In one generation, two at the most, Germany will be an Islamic country. France and the Netherlands, too. Can you imagine what life will be like for the Jews then?
Why don't you leave us out of it and explain to me how you're going to get rid of 25 million Muslims?
By encouraging them to leave.
And if they don't? Deportations will be necessary.
All of them? Every last one.
What's your role in this? Are you Adolf Eichmann or Heinrich Himmler?
I'm the chief of operations. I funnel the order's money to our chosen political parties and run our intelligence and security service.
I assume you have a cyber unit. A good one. Between the order and the Russians, little of what your average Western European reads online these days is true. Are you working with them?
The Russians?
Esterman shook his head. But more often than not, our interests align. The Chancellor of Austria is quite fond of the Kremlin.
Jörg Kaufmann? He's our rock star. Even the American president adores him. And he doesn't like anyone.
What about Giuseppe Saviano?
Thanks to the order, he came from nowhere to win the last election.
Cécile Leclerc.
A real warrior. She told me that she intends to build a bridge between Marseille and North Africa. Needless to say, the traffic will flow only one way.
That leaves Axel Brunner.
The bombings have given him a real boost in the polls.
You wouldn't know anything about them, would you?
My old friends at BFV are convinced the cell is based in Hamburg. It's a real mess, Hamburg. Lots of radical mosques. Brunner will clean it up once he's in power.
Gabriel smiled. Thanks to you, the only way Brunner will ever see the inside of the Federal Chancellery is if he gets a job as a janitor. Esterman was silent.
You were on the verge of getting everything you wanted, and yet you put it all at risk by murdering an old man with a bad heart. Why kill him? Why not simply wait for him to die? That was the plan.
What changed?
The old man found a book in the secret archives, said Esterman. And then he tried to give it to you.
Chapter 42. Munich. It was in early October, after the Holy Father's return from a long weekend at Castel Gandolfo, that the order realized it had a problem. His health failing, perhaps sensing that the end was near, he had embarked on a review of the Vatican's most sensitive documents, especially those related to the early church and the Gospels. Of particular interest to His Holiness were the apocryphal Gospels, books the Church Fathers had excluded from the New Testament. Cardinal Domenico Albanese, the prefetto of the secret archives, carefully curated the Holy Father's reading list, hiding material he did not want the pontiff to see. But quite by chance, while visiting the papal study with several other curial cardinals, he noticed a small book, several centuries old, bound in cracked red leather, lying on the table next to the Holy Father's desk. It was an apocryphal piece of early Christian writing that was supposed to be locked in the collezione. When Albanese asked the Holy Father how he had obtained the book, His Holiness replied that it had been given to him by a certain Father Joshua, a name Albanese did not recognize. Alarmed, Albanese immediately informed his superior general, Bishop Hans Richter, who in turn contacted the order's chief of security and intelligence, Andreas Esterman. Several weeks later, in mid-November, Esterman learned the Holy Father had begun work on a letter he intended to give to the man who had saved his life during the attack on the Vatican.
And thus, said Esterman, his fate was sealed.
How did you know about the letter?
I planted a transmitter in the papal study years ago. I heard the Holy Father telling Donati that he was writing to you.
But Lucchesi didn't tell Donati why he was writing to me.
I heard the Pope tell someone else. I was never able to determine who he was talking to. In fact, I couldn't hear the other person's voice.
Why was the order so worried about the prospect of Lucchesi giving me the book?
Let me count the ways.
You were afraid it called into question the historical accuracy of the Gospels.
Obviously.
But you were also concerned about the book's provenance. It was given to the order in 1938 by a wealthy Roman Jew named Emanuele Giordano, along with a large sum of cash and several works of art. Signore Giordano did not make this contribution out of the goodness of his heart. The order was running quite an extortion racket in the 30s. They targeted wealthy Jews who were promised protection and life-saving baptismal certificates in exchange for cash and valuables. That money was the venture capital for the Wolf Group. Gabriel paused. All of which I would have exposed if Lucchese had placed the book in my hands.
Not bad, Alon. I always heard you were good.
How did the Gospel of Pilate end up in the secret archives?
Father Schiller turned it over to Pius XII in 1954. His Holiness should have burned it. He buried it in the archives instead. If Father Joshua hadn't found it, Lucchese would still be alive.
How did Father Graf kill him? The question surprised Esterman. After a moment's hesitation, he held up the first two fingers of his right hand and moved his thumb as though squeezing the plunger of a syringe.
What was in it?
Fentanyl. Apparently the old man put up quite a fight. Father Graf gave him the injection through his soutane and held his hand over his mouth as he was dying. One of the tasks of the Camerlengo is to supervise the preparation of the Holy Father's body for burial. Abenezer made certain no one noticed the small hole in his right thigh.
I think I'll put a hole in Father Graf the next time I see him.
Gabriel laid a photograph on the table. A man in a motorcycle helmet on the Ponte Vecchio in Florence, right arm extended, a gun in his hand.
He's a rather good shot. I trained him myself.
Did Niklaus let him into the papal apartments the night of the murder?
Esterman nodded. Did he know what Father Graf was planning to do? Saint Niklaus?
Esterman shook his head. He loved the Holy Father and Donati.
Father Graf manipulated him into opening the door. I heard Niklaus go into the study a few minutes after Father Graf left. That's when he took the letter off the desk.
Gabriel placed it on the table, next to the photograph.
Where did you find it?
It was in his pocket when he was killed.
What does it say?
It says, you'd better tell me what happened to the Gospel of Pilate after Albanese removed it from the study.
He gave it to Bishop Richter.
And what did Bishop Richter do with it?
He did what Father Schiller and Pius XII should have done a long time ago.
He destroyed it? The German nodded. Gabriel drew the beretta from the small of his back.
How do you want the story to end?
I want to see my children again.
Correct answer. Now let's try for two in a row. Gabriel leveled the beretta at Esterman's head.
Where's the book?
There was a heated quarrel, but then no office operation was complete without one. Yaakov Rossmann appointed himself the spokesman for the opposition. The team, he argued, had already pulled off the near impossible. Hastily assembled in a city on high alert, it had succeeded in making a former German intelligence officer disappear without a trace. Under skillful interrogation, he had surrendered the information necessary to prevent the Catholic Church from falling into the hands of a malignant, reactionary order with ties to Europe's far right. What was more, the proverbial tree had fallen in the operational forest without a sound. It is better not to push their luck with a risky final gambit, said Yaakov. Better to put Esterman on ice and make a leisurely run for Munich Airport.
I'm not leaving without that book, said Gabriel, and Esterman is going to get it for me.
What makes you think he'll agree to it?
Because it's better than the alternative.
What if he's lying? Asked Yaakov. What if he's sending you on a wild goose chase?
He isn't. Besides, his story is easily verifiable.
How?
The phone.
The phone to which Gabriel was referring belonged to Father Marcus Graf. Gabriel ordered Unit 8200, which had gained access to the device after acquiring its number, to check the GPS data stored in the operating system. Shortly after 5 a.m., Munich time, Yuval Gershon called back with the unit's findings. The GPS data matched Esterman's story, at which point all debate ended. There was, however, a minor problem of transport.
If things go sideways up there, said Elie Lavon, you won't be able to get back to Rome tonight.
Not without a private plane, conceded Gabriel.
Where are we going to get a plane?
I suppose we could just steal one.
Could be messy.
In that case, we'll borrow one instead.
Martin Landesmann, the Swiss financier and philanthropist, famously slept only 3 hours a night. Therefore, when he answered his phone at 5:15, he sounded alert and full of entrepreneurial vitality. Yes, he said, business was good. Quite good, in fact. No, he replied with a mirthless laugh, he was not selling nuclear components to the Iranians again. Because of Gabriel, all that was in Landesmann's past. And you, he asked earnestly, how's your business these days? International chaos is a growth industry. I'm always looking for investment opportunities. Financing isn't a problem, Martin. What I need is a plane. I'm taking the Boeing business jet to London later this morning, but the Gulfstream is available. I suppose it will have to do. Where and when? Gabriel told him. Destination? Tel Aviv, with a brief stopover at Ciampino in Rome. Where shall I send the bill? Put it on my tab. Gabriel rang off and called Donati in Rome. I was beginning to think I would never hear from you, he said. Don't worry. I have everything you need. How bad is it? 12 on the Bishop Richter scale. But I'm afraid there's a complication involving someone close to the previous pope. I'd rather not discuss it over the phone. When will you be here? I need to tie up one or two loose ends before